of the Gospels from other sources. And this writer in the last century said this about the reason why it's important. It is obvious that if the apostles were liable to error in matters of ordinary knowledge, in regard of which we have the means of testing them, this would necessarily throw discredit on all that they say of things in which we cannot test them. Really, our confidence in what they say of doctrine or of the will of God and of moral and spiritual truths and facts is based on their perfect reliability concerning things within the range of our investigation. In other words, if we find out that the writers of the gospel records are making mistakes in terms of basic history, in terms of customs and so on, then how can we trust them when it comes to the things about which we can't trust them, namely what exactly our Lord said and what happened, say, on the resurrection morning? So that is why it's more than just academic interest that the gospel writers are, in fact, can be shown to be true in matters where we can trust them. Now, as Paley, who was one of the people who is still somewhat known for his book Evidences of Christianity, said, the inspired penman wrote of the times in which they or their immediate predecessors lived, agreeing not only in articles of public history, but sometimes in minute, recondite, and very peculiar circumstances in which, of all others, a forger is most likely to have been found tripping. So it's not only in matters of public history, we'll look at a few examples of that, but in little details that only someone who was there and very much aware of what went on would know it. Now let's give a simple example. If I was presumed to write a history of New Mexico from, say, 1880 to 1910, and the best sources I had were some old history books, I'll guarantee you right now that Brother Walker would be able to rip the thing apart. Because there would be errors in those histories, there would be details that he was aware of from his forebears that somebody like me coming along later would not know anything about, and it would become very evident very quickly that I did not know much about the history of New Mexico. Now, likewise, if it was true that the gospel records were not written early on, but way down here, somewhere near AD 100, after editors and so forth had worked them over, they would not have gotten these exact historical nuances that we're going to now try to demonstrate exist in the gospel records. And let me just tell you one other thing about why I think it's important. I've never been put to torture for my faith. But many brothers and sisters down through history have been. And when the torture is applied, isn't the time to begin wondering about whether or not what we believe is the truth. So it's of more than just academic interest that we're looking at these. Maybe we don't face persecution at the moment, but we certainly, each one of us, face every day the breath of temptation. And it seems to my mind that our reaction to temptation or persecution or anything else unpleasant in life finally is based upon our conviction about whether or not what we say we believe, we really believe. Hence the reason for going over this morning. Now this writer, and it's a fairly long extract, but let me just read it anyways, and then we will get into it. Had the evangelists been false historians, they would not have committed themselves to so many particulars. I always write in generalities if you don't know what you're talking about. They would not have furnished the vigilant inquirers of that period with such an effectual instrument for bringing them into discredit with the people, nor foolishly supplied in every page of their narrative so many materials for a cross-examination which would have infallibly have disgraced them. Now we of this age can institute the same cross-examination. We can compare the evangelical writers with contemporary authors and verify a number of circumstances in the history, government, and peculiar economy of the Jewish people. We therefore have it in our power to institute a cross-examination of the writers of the New Testament, and the freedom and frequency of the allusions to these circumstances supply us with ample materials for it. The fact that they are borne out in their minute and incidental allusions by the testimony of other historians gives a strong weight of what has been called circumstantial evidence in their favor. Now, the first one we're going to compare them with is Josephus. And I've used this extract from Encyclopedia Judaica because for two reasons. One, they are hardly interested in verifying the Gospels, the people that wrote Encyclopedia Judaica. And secondly, I think as we get into Josephus, we'll see that he can hardly be have had as his purpose in writing to verify details in the Gospel. Now, Gary was talking about Josephus earlier this morning. Let me just briefly review Josephus. He was born in about A.D. 37, in the time of the Roman invasion of Palestine, A.D. 66 to 70. He ended up being a Jewish general up in Galilee there, where Gary was telling us. And finally it came that there, Josephus says in the introduction to his works, in the part called his life, he says there were 40 men left who drew lots to kill each other, just as they did at Masada. It came down that there were two left, and Josephus convinced the other fellow to surrender to the Romans. As Gary then said, he was in line to die himself, and I'm not just sure exactly when, but he told Vespasian that there was a prophecy, it was actually the prophecy of Daniel 9, that at that very time, a ruler would arise in the east who would go on to rule the world. He told Vespasian that it was in fact going to be Vespasian. And when this came to pass, Vespasian and later his son Titus thought this was okay. So what they did, they took Josephus down to Jerusalem, and he gives us an eyewitness account of the destruction of Jerusalem. He was right there. Then he went to Rome, picked up the name Flavius, and about AD 75, he was commissioned by Vespasian and Titus to write his book, the first book he wrote, which was called The Wars of the Jews. And the purpose of The Wars of the Jews actually was to convince other people in the Roman Empire not to rebel against Rome. Because look what happened to the Jews when they rebelled against Rome. It was a bit of a propaganda document. So The Wars of the Jews came out in about AD 75. Well, while he was there, he noticed the tremendous anti-Semitism in Rome and indeed throughout the Roman Empire. And part of the anti-Semitism was, he thought, as a result of the fact that the Gentiles didn't understand the Jews. They didn't know anything about their history. So about AD 93, he issued his document called The Antiquities of the Jews, which is a much longer document in which he goes over the history of the Jews from Abraham right down to his own time, right down to the time of the Jewish War. Now, I just want to read this very quickly because I want to tell you why I'm reading it. Josephus may not have been a perfect historian. He had biases. He was self-serving. I mean, he was out to look after Josephus first. Nevertheless, he did use sources which he identifies. He did have access in Rome to all the Roman documents concerning the fall of Jerusalem and so forth. And as Gary pointed out, he's not only been verified with respect to Masada in the major outlines, but he's also been verified in a few more obscure things, which tend to indicate that while he may not be perfectly reliable in every last detail, by and large, he is a basically reliable historian of the very times of which the Gospels also write out. So here is what Encyclopedia Judaica said about him. It must be emphasized that the excellence of the work in both its literary and historiographic qualities earns it an honorable place in Jewish and general literature. Much of the Jewish War, now that was the first book he wrote, AD 75, derives from the author's personal observation. He was down there with the Romans as they took the city of Jerusalem. Great significance attaches also to some of the descriptions of the war, which are almost certainly based on Roman military reports, their Roman origin being apparent in their style, which is concise, dry, and devoid of all rhetorical embellishment. Josephus' sources for the material on the introductory section were a work of the Hasmonean dynasty, originally written in Hebrew, and Nicholas of Damascus' great work, which provided him with the information on the Herodian dynasty. Now, I don't want to go all through this, but He did use other sources, which he identifies. This Nicholas of Damascus, some of his material is still available. And he also goes on down here, Agrippa, which is the Herod in Agrippa the Second. Agrippa the First was the Herod who put James, the brother of John, to death in Acts 12. He gives an account of Agrippa's reign in relation to the events which took place in the days of emperors Caligula and Claudius, who followed Tiberius. In this part of the Antiquities, it is very likely that Josephus copied the work of his rival Justus of Tiberius, and that work was called On the Crowned Kings of Judah. In it, Justus gave an account of the Jewish kings up to Agrippa the First, apparently on the instructions of Agrippa the Second, who, wishing to glorify the memory of his father, assigned to his secretary, Justus of Tiberia, the task of writing a work describing the activities of Agrippa the First. Now, that's important because this Justus of Tiberia gives a very accurate account of Herod and his relatives, Herod the Great, right through the time of Christ, including who was the high priest and who wasn't the high priest. So we have a very accurate account that Josephus was using, written by somebody right in the kings of the Herod, from just before AD 1 up until about AD 45 or so. Now that's rather important because this is the very time in here in which the gospel records talk about as well. Josephus shared all the defects that characterized contemporary and earlier historians. Nonetheless, he occupies a place of prime importance also as an historian, an importance which is greatly increased because his work is the only surviving source. And without it, we would know little of the history of the Second Temple, nor would it have been possible to write such a history. So I just want to make that point that Josephus is basically a reliable historian. Yes, he had biases. Yes, he was trying to protect himself. Yes, he gave in to some of the prejudices of the Romans. Nevertheless, he himself used sources and he himself had access to material relating right to the time of the gospel records. Now, we'll start off and see whether or not Josephus and the Gospels mutually agree with each other, and not just in matters of public history, but in very obscure details. Now, the first one is the critics have always attacked this account of the Gadarene demoniac. Why have they attacked the account of the Gadarene demoniac? Well, first of all, Gadara is down here somewhere in this area, and even though Matthew says that it happened at, some of the manuscripts say it happened at Gergesa, better manuscripts, even in Matthew, put it down here in Gadara, which is where Luke and Mark record. I think it's a very similar word in the Greek, and really we're talking about something that happened down here at Gadara, where Jesus came across the Sea of Galilee, and out came this possessed man that he had to deal with right away. Now, the reason the critics have been so adamant about this particular incident is that the record says there was nigh unto the mountains a great herd of swine feeding. Now, the critics have said, there you go. See, they didn't know what they were talking about, because how could there be swine in a Jewish community? We all know that the law forbade the eating of hogs, and what else would they be raising a great herd of then but to eat? So here we have a clear case where the historian, allegedly giving us this account of what happened over there at Gadara, didn't know what he was talking about, because this was a Jewish country, and here we have Mark, Luke, and Matthew all representing it as if there would be swine feeding over there. Well, Josephus, on a writing about something completely different, how does he explain it? This should be Archelaus. There were also certain cities which paid tribute to Archelaus, Stratus Tower in Sebaste, with Joppa and Jerusalem. For as to Gaza, Gadara, and Hippus, they were Grecian cities, which Caesar separated from his own government and added them to the province of Syria. How does Josephus, writing about something completely different, explain that event in the Gospels? They weren't Jewish cities anymore. They were Grecian cities. And indeed, I wish I'd brought it with me, but we have coins of Gadara which show that they were worshippers actually of Ashtaroth. So, you see, we're starting now. Now, did Josephus write this account to explain Mark? Absolutely not. But they agreed. And only somebody who was very familiar with what really happened and is just simply relating what happened, first of all, does Mark try to explain why there were swine there? Absolutely not. Look, I'm just going to write it down. That's what happened. Peter recalled to me that out there we went to Gadara and there were swine there. Take it or leave it. But there's going to be no explanation given. Now, had this been made up years later, what do you suppose would have... Somebody had read Josephus and then was trying to put this together. What would they have said, undoubtedly? They would try to explain what Gadara was. But no, it just sits there. Now, when Josephus is talking about Herod the Great, remember, he was the one that was around when the wise men came, and he died very shortly thereafter. Here is what Josephus... Remember, he was dealing with documents that he had access to. This man, Justus of Tiberias, wrote a history, fortunately for us, of the Herods, right up to Agrippa the First. Now, Herod, I've put in here the Great, altered his testament upon the alteration of his mind, for he appointed Antipas, to whom before he left the kingdom, to be tetrarch. So this is what is called Herod. Herod Antipas. He's just called Herod. Herod was a name something like Caesar. So Herod Antipas, he appoints tetrarch of Galilee and Berea, and granted the kingdom in the south to Archelaus. Remember that. What he did was, as Gary said, he was only had about 4 days to live. The first, when he found out that one of his sons, Antipas, who he had promised the whole kingdom to, was happy that his father was going to die, he had him put to death. And then there was only three left. Down here, he gave Archelaus the kingdom. And tetrarch simply comes from the same word as tetrahedron, which means, tetrarch means a quarter. Half of the thing, the kingdom he gave to Archelaus here in the south, and Herod Antipas he gave to Galilee, and this Herod was the one who dogged Jesus all through his ministry in Galilee. And Philip, the other half-brother, he gave this area up here and over here. And Philip, of course, renamed Panias, as Gary was talking about, Caesarea Philippi, both after himself and Caesar. So you see how complicated the history's already getting. You've got to know your stuff or you start to get mixed up. He also gave Gallinitis and Trachonitis and Panias, which later became Caesarea Philippi, to Philip, who was his own son, but own brother to Archelaus by the name of a tetrarchy, and bequeathed these other places to Salome, his sister. Now, Luke gets this right. He says the same thing, that in the 15th year of Tiberius Caesar, Herod was tetrarch of Galilee, which is what Josephus says, and he mentions here in Berea, which was just sort of a subdivision of Galilee, and his brother Philip, who Josephus mentions, he says, was tetrarch of Iturea, the region of Trachonitis, which encompasses, if we check it, up north here to Caesarea Philippi, the same area that Josephus tells us. Not only that, but Josephus, again, in a completely unrelated incident, he's relating something completely different, tells us when it was that Philip died. And what year was it that Philip died, according to Josephus, in that top extract there? The 20th year of Tiberius. What year is Luke talking about here? So it makes, see, again, it fits. Philip reigned according, or lasted as a tetrarch, according to Josephus, up until the 20th year of Tiberius' life, or reign rather, and Luke says that in the 15th year, yes, he was in fact tetrarch of Iturea. Now, This Archelaus that we talked about a minute ago, he was just a bigger wretch as his father, and that's going some. And after 10 years of Archelaus down there in the south in Judea, they couldn't take it anymore. Even his own brothers had had enough. But in the 10th year of Archelaus' government, both his brethren and the principal men of Judea and Samaria, he was in the south, and Philip and Herod Antipas were up in the north, not being able to bear his barbarous and tyrannical usage of them, accused him before Caesar, and that especially because he had broken the commands of Caesar. Now, it's Archelaus we're talking about. When Joseph came back from Egypt in Matthew 2 and 22, who was he afraid of? Archelaus. Now, Matthew doesn't explain why Joseph was afraid of Archelaus down there in the south in Judea, but what does Josephus undesignedly tell us? Well, Josephus says he was such a horrible person, for lack of a better phraseology, that after 10 years his own brethren besought, his own flesh and blood appealed to Caesar to get rid of him. So obviously, right from the start, Archelaus was someone to be feared. And hence, when Joseph hears that the same Archelaus did reign in Judea in the room of his father, following the same policies of his father, he was afraid to go thither. Notwithstanding being warned of a God in a dream, he turned aside into the parts of Galilee. So he was coming up here from Egypt in the south, heard that Archelaus, who was no better than Herod the Great, was now in charge, and instead of going into this area, went up here into Galilee, where Herod was tetrarch. And of course, much of Jesus' ministry was up here in Galilee, where he had to deal with Herod the tetrarch. Now we're going to see whether the gospel writers agree with Josephus in very, very obscure details. And the detail is in verse 3 of Matthew 26. I don't think you need to make notes. I'm just trying to give you a flavor of how the gospel records tie in with other historians. In verse 3, there's an implication there. Would you look up Matthew 27 just for a minute? Verse 22. You will see that there is a rather peculiar phraseology used there of our Lord, where he says, Pilate says, "What shall I do then with Jesus, which is called Christ?" Now here in Matthew 26, verse 3, we have this very similar language construction. "Then assembled together the chief priests and the scribes and the elders of the people unto the palace of the high priest, who was called Caiaphas." Now, what does that seem to imply? If Jesus was called Christ, what does it seem that Matthew is saying here, who was called Caiaphas? Or what is one implication? That he had another name. He was called Caiaphas, but he had another name, which none of the gospel writers give us. Now, Josephus, when writing about the priesthood, talks about the fact that Vitellus, also deprived Joseph, uses the same phraseology of Matthew, who is called Caiaphas. Now you see, Matthew obviously knew that this man had another name, which he doesn't, neither he nor the other writers of the gospel records give us, but they don't see fit, other than that very, very obtuse allusion in Matthew, that he was called Caiaphas, but he really had a different name. And Josephus, original name, and Josephus, writing about the priesthood, incidentally mentions that this man was called Caiaphas and he had another name. Now you see, only somebody who was really there, who really knew all what was going on with the priesthood, would have known that little detail. Now let's look at the priesthood a little more carefully. Because Luke says, and the critics have said, there you go again, this guy doesn't know his stuff. Because in verse 2, he says, when he's giving this the 15th year of Tiberius Caesar, he says that Annas and Caiaphas, being the high priests. Now we all know how many high priests were there in Israel? One. Here you have a writer, here's an historical error where we have an obvious error because Luke says there were priests, plural. Now, how could anything be more inaccurate than that? Now, in fact, Luke is telling it the way it was. There were two priests, in effect, one de facto and one de jure, one in fact and one in law. And here's how it worked. Tiberius, who was the emperor, sent Valerius Gratius to be procurator of Judea. The man deprived Annas, this is the same Annas, Josephus just spells it slightly different, of the high priesthood. So the first thing he did was he deprived Annas of the high priesthood. Now how would Annas have had that high priesthood? A succession, according to the Jewish way of doing things. Now the Romans come in and say, no, we're not going to have Annas as high priest. And here's what he did. He appointed Ismael, the son of Phabi, to be high priest. In a little while, he deprived him of the high priest and ordained Eleazar, the son of Annas, who had been high priest before, to be high priest. Which office, when he held it for a year, Gratus deprived him of it and gave the high priest to Simon, the son of Camithus. And when he had possessed the dignity no longer than a year, Joseph Caiaphas, who later he tells us Joseph called Caiaphas, was made his successor. Now a couple of things. Who, as far as the Jews were concerned, would really be the high priest? Annas. So you'll see that is who is named first. Now, I want you to look at John 11 and 49. Or John 18 and 13, sorry. John 18 and 13. Where was Jesus taken early that morning or very late that night? Where was he taken? Why was he taken? What does it say specifically? He was taken to Annas what? Why was he taken there? John doesn't explain why. Because he was really the high priest as far as the Jews were concerned. Caiaphas had to carry it out because the Romans had put him there. But really, Annas, who was named first by Luke, Annas was the one to whom Jesus was taken first, was really the high priest in effect. Now one other thing, look at John 11 and 49. People have said John didn't know what he was talking about. What is the expression that you think the critics have really ridden hard in John 11 and 49? Well, the thing that they've really come after is this fact. He says he was the high priest that year. He was one of the council of the chief priests and Pharisees, and one of them was Caiaphas. But the phrase that they've really picked up on is being the high priest that same year. Now, how can anybody be so foolish as to think that the high priesthood was a yearly thing? Well, how does Josephus explain that? We were going through a period when the Romans were changing high priests like you change a dirty shirt. The priesthood was being changed every other year by the Romans right at this period of time. And so when he says that being the high priest that year, the Romans, as we can see here from this extract from Josephus, were changing the high priest virtually yearly. But the ruling power behind it all was Annas. Now you see, unless you knew what was going on intimately in Judea, right in Jerusalem, you would never get two historical records to meld like that. And there's no attempt by the evangelists to explain why there was two high priests. Accept it, there it is. It's only when we see other documents that we realize how true the record really is. Okay, now we want to talk a little bit about Herod. Boy, we are sure going to run out of time here. Past Herod the Tetrarch up in Galilee that fit right in with the scriptures that we're only going to just be able to just maybe touch on a couple. At this time, Herodias, king of Arabia, and Herod had a quarrel on the account of the following. Herod the Tetrarch had married the daughter of Herodias, who had lived and had lived with her a great while. But when he was once at Rome, he lodged with Herod. This is the Philip Herod, rather than Herod Antipas, who was his brother, which is what Luke says, but not by the same mother. For this Herod was the son of the high priest Simon's daughter. However, he fell in love with Herodias, this last Herod's wife. This man ventured to talk about a marriage between them, which address when she admitted, an agreement was made for her to change her habitation and come to him as soon as he should return from Rome. An article of this marriage also was this, that he should divorce Herodias' daughter. And then later on, he says, but Herodias, their sister, was married to Herod Philip, the son of Herod the Great, who had a daughter, Salome, after whose birth Herodias took upon her to confound the laws of our country, divorce herself from her husband while he was alive, and was married to Herod Antipas, her husband's brother, by her father's side. He was Tetrarch of Galilee. Now these details are, of course, confirmed by the gospel record, where Mark says, for Herod himself had sent forth and laid hold upon John and bound him in prison for Herodias' sake, the same woman mentioned by Josephus, the same relation, his brother Philip's, that is, the brother of Herod, Philip's wife, for he had married her. For John had said unto Herod, it is not lawful for thee to have thy brother's wife. Therefore Herodias had a quarrel against him and would have killed him, but she could not. Now, the point I want to make is, just as in Josephus, Herodias had a daughter. It isn't the daughter of Herod Antipas and Herodias. It's the daughter of Herodias by her previous husband, Philip. And true to the record, the daughter is called the daughter of said Herodias, not the daughter of Herod and Herodias, but the daughter of Herodias, which of course we know came from Philip up here. Now, I just want to show you how many allusions there are. What day did this whole event, does the gospel writers just in passing note that it happened on? What day? His birthday. And Josephus, writing about some other subject entirely, just happens to note in passing that when Herod Agrippa I was solemnizing his birthday, he gave festival entertainments to all his subjects. And there's another allusion in a story, and I wasn't able to look up, to the fact that the Herods, when they were in Rome, on their birthday, had great celebrations. It just so happens, as they go through, that they mention that it was on his birthday that these events occurred, that he had all his great men gathered together. Now, what would a forger have done, do you suppose? Just with any of this. I suggest to you, if a forger was writing this, he would have made a big deal about the fact it was his birthday. Oh yeah, as we know from, you know, on his birthday, of course, it was the custom of the Herods to have great festivals. But they just mention it, that it so happens it was on his birthday that this event involving John the Baptist occurred. Now you see, you can't, the histories just weld together, which is what we would expect if the evangelists were simply writing an honest account of what they remembered and what was being delivered to them by the eyewitnesses. I want you to look up Luke 3 for a minute. It's been a question in verse 14. There's a very specific word used there. John the Baptist is out preaching here along the River Jordan.
And the word that Luke uses is that soldiers under arms came out to see him. In verse 14, the soldiers under arms likewise demanded of him, saying, "And what shall we do?" and so on. It's a very peculiar word, only occurring once in the New Testament. And the question is, how could it have been? It wasn't Roman soldiers coming out to hear him. How could there have been at this time soldiers under arms right around here where John the Baptist would have encountered them? Who were those soldiers? Well, it all relates back to Herod. Herod, Tetrarch of Galilee, had divorced his wife, who was the daughter of Aretas, king of Arabia. And Aretas said, "Well, I'm not going to stand for that, Herod. I am going to come and teach you a lesson." So they raised armies on both sides and prepared for war and sent their generals to fight instead of themselves. And when they had joined battle, Herod's army was destroyed by the treachery of some fugitives. So Herod wrote about these affairs to Tiberius. Now, just as Gary had pointed out, I believe it was yesterday, Rome allowed a certain autonomy. And these two, Aretas wasn't under the dominion of Rome, but certainly Herod was. And as a result, to defend his daughter's honor, Aretas and Herod had a war, which Herod got bested in. Now, what brought about this war? What event brought about this war? The divorce of his daughter. What did John the Baptist... Why was he thrown in prison? Because he objected to Herod, after divorcing Aretas' daughter, he objected to Herod taking Philip's wife. When was this all going on, obviously? It was all going on at the same time. The divorce and the marriage of Herod to Philip's former wife was all going on at the same time, because it was then that John the Baptist spoke out against what he had done. Therefore, the soldiers that were there speaking to John the Baptist down here in Galilee, or down here in Judea, were the soldiers of Herod getting ready to engage in this war with Philip, with Aretas. Now look, I'm trying to keep all the details straight, and I've been looking at this, but a forger... To know that, to dream up that Aretas, because Herod had divorced his daughter, was going to have a war with this Herod. And just incidentally in Luke, we find out that there are armed men under arms, at the very same time, down here talking to John the Baptist. The histories all fit together, but certainly nobody could ever claim that it was contrived. And we are running out of time. And I am going to move along here. We'll do a simple one here. If you look at your map, of course, in order to go from Galilee down to Judea, you had to go through one other province, Samaria. Now, we know from the gospel records... And that is the wrong reference. That when Jesus was going up to the Passover, his final Passover, he sent messengers before his face, and they went and entered into a village of the Samaritans to make ready for him. And they did not receive him, because his face was as though he would go to Jerusalem. John tells us that the Jews have no dealings with the Samaritans. Now Josephus, shortly after the time of Christ, relates an event very similar to what happened to our Lord. Now, there arose a quarrel between the Samaritans and the Jews on the occasion of the following. It was the custom of the Galileans, when they came to the holy city at the festivals, to take their journeys through the country of the Samaritans. Exactly what our Lord did. It confirms exactly what he did. And at this time there lay, in the road they took, a village that was called Gania, which was situated in the limits of Samaria and the great plain, where certain persons thereto belonging fought with the Galileans and killed a great many of them. So the record that we read in the Gospels is true. There was no love lost between the Galileans, the Jews in the south, and the Samaritans. And very shortly after the Samaritans had rejected Christ, because his face was as it was, he would go to Jerusalem, there was an outright slaughter of the Galileans by the Samaritans. Again, it doesn't exactly confirm it, but it certainly tells us that in this time, exactly as the gospel writers portray it, there was no love lost between the Galileans and the Samaritans. Well, we've got all this to get through in 4 minutes, because there are so many historical allusions, and we're just going to flip through here until I find one that I think I can explain in about 3 minutes. Okay, this is a fairly straightforward one. If you look at Matthew 22, this is where they came to him and said, "Okay, tell us, is it lawful to pay tribute to Caesar or not?" They were putting him in a vice, and the vice was this. The Jews had this interpretation of Deuteronomy 17 and 15. Here is what it was. "Thou shalt in any wise set him king over thee, whom the Lord thy God shall choose. One from among thy brethren shalt thou set king over thee. Thou mayest not set a stranger over thee, which is not thy brother." Now the zealots interpreted this to mean, yes, it's true that we didn't set the Romans over us, but now that they are over us, we are contravening this part of the law if we pay Caesar. Because then we would be contravening this law. We would recognize that though he is a stranger, he had a right to reign over us. So the vice they put Christ in, or tried to put him in, was this. They said, look, this is our interpretation of the law. This is the interpretation of the people. Now, if you say we should pay tribute to Caesar, you're violating the law. If he said, don't pay tribute to Caesar, what would be the charge on the part of the Roman authorities? Treason. Now, he asked for a coin to be brought, a penny. And this was undoubtedly it. This denarius, as it's called. And he said, looking at this, I'm certain this was the coin, the most common coin in the Roman Empire at that time, the denarius. So he says to them, holding this coin in his hand, whose image and superscription is it? Well, of course, there's the image, here's the superscription. Now, maybe this is stretching things too far, but this is a coin of Tiberius Caesar, and you'll notice that the Tiberius part is covered in two letters. The Caesar is spelled out in full, and then it goes on to say, Tiberius Caesar, divine son of the divine Augustus. It's been suggested that the ruler, the emperors following Tiberius, shortened up Caesar and instead lengthened out Augustus. And therefore, when they said, whose image and superscription, the Caesar here is spelled out in full. Had this been made up later on in time, they probably would have said, reading the coin, Augustus, whose image and superscription, they probably would have said, Augustus. Now let me just, because this is all we're going to be able to do today. People have said Jesus didn't answer the question. Let's just look at what his answer was. Is it lawful to give tribute unto Caesar or not? If he said it was, they would say, you've contravened our law and broken his authority with the people. If he said no, he would have been charged with treason, which of course is what they said at his trial anyways. This man forbiddeth paying tribute to Caesar. Here's what I think he said. He said, look, you've already accepted Caesar. You're using his coins. And by the way, your interpretation of the law is wrong because nobody appointed Caesar over the land of Israel. Caesar appointed himself over the land. So your interpretation here is wrong. You did not appoint somebody who was not thy brother king. Caesar appointed himself. So you're accepting Caesar's coinage to do your day-to-day dealings. Therefore, render to Caesar what is due to Caesar and to God what is to God. He answered the question. He did not give some answer that he tried to weasel out of the question. I don't at all. The fact is their interpretation of the law was wrong. It did not mean that because Caesar was ruling over them, they were violating the law. And it was a fact that God rules in the kingdoms of men. This was the king that God had appointed, and therefore they were to rule, to give to Caesar what was Caesar's, and to God's what was God's. Are we through? Well, I guess we're through. Anyways, just to conclude, can I just do one more quickly? Just bear with me. Look up Luke. Just look up this one quickly. It's Luke 22, verse 25. The kings of the Gentiles exercise lordship over them, and they that exercise authority upon them are called benefactors. That word only occurs once in the entire New Testament. Once. And it's a word that is not common. If a forger was trying to make this up, it's very unlikely he would have chosen the word benefactor. But lo and behold, we find a coin from Syria, just to the north, which would have been circulating here in Galilee. The province of Syria was right up here, and the coins were circulating in Galilee. We find a coin from that very time, King Antiochus of Syria, benefactor, right on the coin. The very word that Jesus used shows up on a coin from that, the exact word, only once in the New Testament. And it was only, apparently, the coins that have been found are just in this area, just right up in Syria and a little bit over in here to a region of Tarsus. Now, I suggest to you that if a forger had been making that up, these coins went out of circulation, a forger making that up would never have gotten such a local word and put it into the mouth of Jesus. We are dealing here with a word that was almost local to Syria and Galilee, and only someone who was totally familiar with the titles that they used in that area would ever have chosen the word benefactor. Our Lord had obviously seen that coin, and hence it comes out naturally. They that exercise lordship over them are called benefactors. Well, sorry, we just got through just a very, very few. The Gospels are full of them.